You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, August 29th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. That's right, folks. On another vacation, la-dee-da. We'll be back in Tuesday, September 3rd. Today is August 29th. Not really, but I'm projecting forward into the future. Today, a national strike of low-wage and restaurant workers is taking place. And apropos of that, we have decided to rerun an interview I did with Sarah Jaffe from earlier this year talking about the first of these strikes, which has spurred on this one, a New York City fast food strike. And also from that same program, it was a couple days after I had been on Up With Chris, got into an argument with a huge plutocrat. Interesting story, and we break it down with sound, so I think you'll enjoy that. And for members, you'll get a bonus interview with Thomas Frank that I recorded last week. So enjoy. Remember, tomorrow on the program, another repeat, but it will be NSA whistleblower Thomas Drake with NSA with whistleblower attorney Jason Raddick. Also, Tim Sharrock, who wrote about these NSA whistleblowers. An important show, particularly in light of everything else that's been going on the past couple of weeks. Don't forget, we'll be back on Tuesday, September 3rd. The app is coming for Android and for iOS, probably somewhere around the second week of September, early the second week. We want everybody to download it on the same day, so we will let you know. Appreciate your listening to the program. You can always become a member at majority.fm. It's your membership that helps this show stay afloat. All right, folks.
Thank you.
Okay, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Sarah Jaffe. She is an independent journalist, a contributor to The Atlantic. She wrote a piece for The Atlantic on this these wildcat strikes that took place in New York City last week at fast food restaurants. Welcome to the program, Sarah.
So, I mean, wildcat strikes isn't exactly right. They were planned in advance and very well coordinated, but they are a different kind of strike than we're used to seeing these days.
All right. Well, then let's be explicit about this. So we had how many people went on strike where were they striking last week?
So over 200 workers at two dozen different fast food franchises went on strike last week in New York. That means they were at McDonald's, Wendy's, Burger King, KFC, Taco Bell, and I believe Domino's Pizza. Workers went on strike at locations around the city. So it was across the industry, and it's across different franchises, different companies, all across the city, but they're all coordinated together. They're trying to form an independent union for fast food workers in New York. It would be the Fast Food Workers Committee.
And so how long have these plans for the strikes been planned?
They've been in the works for months and months now. There have been about 40 organizers, mostly with a group called New York Communities for Change, doing organizing on the ground with these workers at different stores. And it's a really tough organizing jobs for many reasons, one of them being that low-wage workers don't make a lot of money to keep cell phones on and, you know, permanent addresses. So just that bit of struggle alone has been really hard. But it's also been, you know, these are jobs with a lot of turnover. You'll have a great worker, great leader that then leaves. And so it's been really, this is the first time that there's been anything like this in the fast food industry in this country. Any sort of sustained organizing campaign like this with this kind of success.
And that seems to be the tie-in. I mean, I know there's no direct tie-in, although maybe there is some in your reporting. You've come across some relationship to what was happening with the Walmart strikes. But this is one of the biggest challenges, I think, to the union movement in that you have, unlike where, let's say, factories and industry towns, where you have literally a physical congregation of workers to unionize. I mean, if you walk into a factory, there's 1,600 people working there who potentially could benefit from a union. That is a very effective. That makes your organizing that much more effective. But this is, I mean, taken with the Walmart at least organizing, does this signal a change in the way that unions are perceiving what their job is and how to approach it?
I mean, when you look at Walmart, you see a company that unions had tried to organize for a long time, right? Walmart's been around for 50 years. Unions have known that they need to break Walmart, especially as it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, right? It has this huge presence in retail. It sets the wages, and by sets them, we mean drives them down for workers around the country. Unions have known they needed to break Walmart. They haven't been able to, and what's been going on with our Walmart and its success has been largely because they've adapted to that and learned from the workers what kind of things would help them. The fast food workers, this has largely been an industry that's been just left alone. It's been considered too low wage. It's been considered a job for teenagers. It's a high turnover workplace. And because of this franchise issue, right, because McDonald's doesn't control every single store that has the McDonald's name on it. They sell them to franchisees, and they dictate a whole list of rules for the workers at those places. But as, you know, several people noted, I spoke to Stephen Lerner for my story, they don't dictate how workers have to be treated. If McDonald's or Burger King or Wendy's wanted to say, you have to pay your workers a minimum of $15 an hour and they have to get paid sick days, they could also write that into the franchise contracts, the way they write in, you know, the food that they have to sell and the amount that they have to kick back to the company. So they don't do that. And that's, you know, that's one issue. But organizing the workers, the independent stores, they're targeting different bosses, in each place are not all targeting the McDonald's corporation. So it's been, there's multiple layers of why this is really complicated work to do. And so this has been, it took a community group to do it and to see it as community organizing.
I mean, that brings up two questions. One, do you think that strategically, and I imagine that the organizers have that mapped this stuff out. I mean, obviously, you start in New York in many respects because, again, you're talking about a higher concentration of people. And right. you're also, to the extent that there is any parity, I mean, look, you can't get much lower than the wages for a lot of these people, regardless of where you are nationally, because we have a...
Right.
A federal minimum wage. So when you're talking about $7.25 per hour in New York, which is what most of, I guess the median is somewhere around $8.30 or something for these employees.
I think it's like $8.70 nationwide. But yeah, but I did not talk to a single fast food worker in leading up to the strike. And when I was out last Thursday on the picket lines with them, I did not talk to a single worker who made over $8 an hour.
Now, people have to understand that if you're living in New York City and you buy a Metro card to get to work, which I would say the percentage of these workers who are probably having to commute into the city, because I, you know, nobody can afford to live in Manhattan,
right.
is rather high. So you're talking about, you know, $200 a month for a Metro card. And at $7.25, even $8, you know, 40 hours a week, you know, you're talking about $1,200 a month. 200 of that is eaten up. You know, I'm talking before taxes is eaten up by just getting to work. Never mind the hour each way that you're probably spending on that train. So we're now, is the strategy to A, try and get concessions and raise the rates of wages of people in New York, and then take this nationally on the franchisee level or the franchisor level? In other words, once they've been able to, assuming they can organize New York and get a union going in New York, do you then start to go to other major cities around the country, or do you go directly to McDonald's nationally and Burger King and whatnot and say, you've got to write this into your franchise agreements?
I mean, that would be really great. I think what happened here was that, like I said, this started with a community group that is based here in New York, that they were actually doing housing organizing, and they were talking to workers in fast food restaurants about housing issues and finding that, you know, people can't pay for housing when they're making $7.25 an hour. And that led to this kind of organizing in the fast food restaurants. They've also been organizing low-wage workers in the car washes, in grocery stores. So they've been working with low-wage workers across the city, and that's been where this effort came out of. Now, that said, I'm hearing that there are other fast food organizing efforts in, like, Chicago, in other places, where they're working on this a similar kind of approach. And it would be great if this went to McDonald's corporate headquarters. But I think the thing that you're seeing with these kind of one-day strikes and these kind of tactics is that it's less of a, like, we're going to go out on strike until we get what we want, and much more like we're going to keep disrupting business until things change. And it's much more, it's looser, it's more flexible, it builds in momentum, rather than sort of going out on strike and, like, the first week you're really excited and the second week you're getting tired and on the third week you haven't been able to buy groceries because you haven't been working and, oh my God. It can build, and people can come in and out, people can walk out on strike. When I was standing outside of a Wendy's in Brooklyn, one worker who had not originally planned to go out on strike walked out and joined the picket line. You know, it allows for things like that. And it's just going to keep escalating until things get better. And we, you know, hopefully it continues to roll. So even if the workers get their union recognition, then they're organized, then they can push for paid vacation, then they can push for sick days, then they can push for regular cost of living raises or other, you know, issues. That's the benefit of having the union, is that you're then already organized and you already have a mechanism for, you know, asking for more.
Has anybody done any, is there any data on whether or not these jobs are continue to be as they've been perceived to be, and maybe they never were, but at least the perception was that these were transitional jobs, that you,
right.
You either got this job after you got out of high school or out of college, or it was something to do for a summer, or that to the extent that somebody was working there, it was simply a stopgap measure. Do we have any knowledge as to whether or not basically that the percentage of people who enter into this industry, and I'm talking specifically the fast food industry, end up staying right. there for longer than in the past?
You know, I don't know the data for turnover. I know that these tend to be high turnover jobs because, in essence, that's one of the reasons that, you know, they're able, that they're so hard to organize, right? Is that if you, you know, if your manager doesn't like you, he can fire you for any reason whatsoever. And this is true of basically any job in this country where you don't have a written contract either through a union or because you are, you know, somebody who they negotiate contracts with. And so there's always more people, right? Right now we still have high unemployment. We've had, you know, we've seen manufacturing jobs disappear over the last 30 years or so. And so these have become the jobs that fill in those gaps, right? So now instead of it being high school kids, the median age for fast food workers is 28. And not only that, but this is an fast food workers are 2/3 women, and the median age for women in this industry is 32. I mean, these are adult people. These are, you know, these are not kids getting a job after high school or during high school. These are people who are trying to feed their family on minimum wage, and it's ridiculous.
And we should also say, too, that the people have to understand that we are subsidizing. This is the same situation with Walmart. I mean, so in the event that we are talking about wages going up, and even if that causes a nominal increase in the cost of a hamburger, let's say, maybe it goes up. I mean, I would imagine it's less. We're talking about less than 5 cents a hamburger. If you were to pay everybody a living wage there, it's probably lower. But let's assume it is. At the very least, we are beginning to pass on the costs that these companies have managed to basically submerge and hide that everyone is paying. So in other words, we are paying to support their workers, whether it is with Medicaid, whether it's with food stamps, whether it is with any other series of programs so that these people can survive. Meanwhile, we're subsidizing McDonald's to do so. And this is a way of sort of exposing those costs for what they really are.
Right. I mean, yeah, exactly. We're subsidizing McDonald's ability to have a dollar value menu. And that dollar value menu is, you know, that's not what those things actually cost, right? Because the work wages aren't being held down. And, right, we're essentially paying for cheap fast food, whether we eat cheap fast food or not. I mean, I know the health conscious people and you know, a lot of good liberals are like, I would never eat at McDonald's anyway. That stuff's terrible. But, like, well, we're paying for it anyway. we're paying for it through the tax code because we're paying for food stamps. We're paying for Medicaid. We're paying for all these programs that people need. And people who are working a job that is ostensibly a full-time job, although they can never actually get their hours steady or enough of them, we're paying for it. And I don't have a problem with paying for people to have health care. I don't have a problem with my tax dollars going to food stamps. I think that's actually the best use of my tax dollars that I can think of. But we're paying for McDonald's executives to get stupid rich, right? Because, you know, the highest paid executive at McDonald's made like something like $6 or $8, $10 million last year. The highest paid executive at Yum Brands, which owns Taco Bell and KFC, made $20 million last year.
Most of that $20 million gets eaten up between taking Subway, getting a Subway tokens and taxes. But the point is also, I would take it a step further too, that not only do I not mind subsidizing people who need help in this situation and other, frankly, other government programs, but the bottom line is I trust the government to do it better rather than, yes, the like you're saying, the inefficiency involved in my subsidizing the McDonald's CEO's lavish lifestyle.
Right, exactly.
So give me a sense of what happens next here. I mean, obviously it's very unpredictable, and there's a lot right. going on here. But what do you anticipate happening next?
Right. I mean, the great thing about this, right, is that it is sort of rolling, and it's, somebody used the term viral strikes in relation to the Walmart strikes, which I think is exactly what's going on here, right? And here, there's going to be a rally this Thursday in New York, and it's going to be the fast food workers along with a bunch of other low-wage workers who've been organizing. And, I mean, I think what we're seeing is the beginnings of a movement of low-wage workers. Right? You're seeing Walmart, you're seeing fast food, you're seeing car wash workers, you're seeing people across the country saying, hey, I've been demonized by politicians who talk about food stamps and talk about all this stuff, and I work my butt off, and I deserve some recognition, and we deserve some better pay. There's no reason that these jobs have to be low-paying jobs, just like there was no reason that working on an assembly line at Ford had to be a low-paying job, right? The CIO, the Congress of Industrial Union Organizations, was built out of these low-skill, very, they were very low-paying jobs, and they were deliberately broken down on the assembly line so that, you know, one person just did one task over and over all day long. They were miserable jobs. They were terrible. They became those good middle-class jobs that politicians love to talk about because the workers organized. And if this stuff starts to work, we have, you know, this is a whole other generation that'll change the life of millions of people.
Well, we'll continue to follow this story. I should also correct myself. I think I said $200 for a Metro card over the course of a month. It's closer to about $105. But
$105 now, but they want to raise it to $125. So.
Right. I mean, that's a huge chunk of someone's pay. If you're making $7.25, $8 an hour, and maybe getting 35 hours a week at one of these restaurants. Sarah, I appreciate you coming on and walking us through this thing, and we'll continue to watch for your reporting on this.
Great. Thanks a lot.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'm going to walk you through with sound clips of this exchange that I had on Chris Hayes' program this weekend with a massive plutocrat. It was... It really got under my skin. I think that's why I was brought on, frankly, to the program. And then a little bit later in the program, we'll be taking your phone call, 646-257-3920. The IM machine is working today. Majority FM or any of my IM handles that you may have, legacy handles, and, of course, Majority FM at jabber.org. We'll be right back in just a moment. And, again, if you can become a member of the Majority Report, please do. It's not the only way to support the program, but it is the most efficient way of supporting the program. You can also, of course, if you buy junk through Amazon, buy it through our link at majority.fm, support the show. You can just look at the top of the website. It says support the show. Click it. You can see other ways of supporting the show, including buying your coffee through justcoffee.coop, fair trade, coffee, tea, chocolate, organic. If you want it, the coffee's great. The company's fantastic. Couldn't be a better situation for everybody involved. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a minute. Hey, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. That is arguably my one of my maybe my favorite band ever. I don't know. It's pretty close. I can't. It's Buffalo Tom, but I can't. I don't know. Maybe it's one of my top five. Let's put it that way. Sunflower Suit. All right. So now what we're going to do is I'm going to walk you through this weekend. I was on Up with Chris, and as many of you know, on occasion I have filled in for Chris Hayes. I've had him on this program many times. This version of the Majority Report, he claims that the first time he ever did media was on the old Majority Report. Maybe the case. I don't know. The point being is that I know that when I am brought on that program, often they are there's a reason. You know, being a bit of a generalist, I'm not bringing some of the expertise that some of the other guests do on that show. I am bringing the ability to talk, but they find people who can talk. And in this instance, all I was told was coming on to talk about the grand bargain and the role that so-called entitlements, social insurance programs are playing in the context of the grand bargain. And when I got there, I found out that one of the guests, and I was doing like the middle segment, 8:30 or something after the filibuster reform segment, which was actually fascinating. And so the original guest who was supposed to be on with us as well, I can't remember who it was a an expert on these programs, an economist. And so but they had laryngitis. They couldn't show up, whatever it was. So I was on with Richard Arenberg, who was the author of Defending the Filibuster, who had been in the segment prior, Victoria DeFrancesco Soto, who's an MSNBC contributor, and I think she's a senior analyst at Latino Decisions and a fellow at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. And this other guy, Don Peebles, who is the chairman and CEO of the Peebles Corporation and a member of President Obama's National Finance Committee. Now, the Finance Committee is basically, I can't remember what the Bush pioneers or basically the guy in charge of helping raise money and then sticks around to advise on issues of money. I didn't really think much. I didn't know if there was going to be an argument about any of these. I had no idea. It didn't even occur to me. I was really very focused on making sure that I ate a piece of pastry on camera, because that apparently is a there's a massive Up with Chris subculture that is focused on that. And I also I have a propensity when I see free pastry to eat it. I can't help it. So the we started off with Chris going through the state of the negotiations, and this is And at one point, I explained that what was really interesting in terms of what was happening is that the Republicans, their bluff has basically been called. The Democrats said, if you want to cut so-called entitlements, social insurance, just tell us what it is. And the Republicans came back with, well, no. You have to tell us what you propose to cut out of Medicare and Social Security. And this is the game that the Republicans have played in the past. They get the Democrats to make a cut, and then the Republicans have run against them on that cut. And then they went to Peebles talking about President Obama's new grand bargain position. DeFrancesca Soto talks about getting into more cuts and how people supposedly have been pulling off from Norquist. And then this is what happens. Peebles sort of pivots, and you can it occurred to me at one point, probably during the break after the segment, that's why he's here. Not just to pontificate on it, but he literally, this is his agenda. This is clip number one.
Programs, obviously, and the Republicans don't.
Okay, we'll start that over again. So here is Don or Donahue Peebles talking about what's next in the grand bargain.
Well, I don't think anybody wants to cut programs, obviously, and the Republicans don't because they're now in what they consider the rebuilding mode. But, you know, the challenge is going to be that there are Democrats. If you take a look at some of these tax issues, for example, estate taxes, the president is not going to have unified support from the House on that issue because he's going to lose, most likely, the Congressional Black Caucus. He's going to lose representatives of farming states because it's going to decimate
It is not going to decimate.
Well, actually,
that is
no.
an absolute ridiculous.
Okay, now wait a second. Let me explain what just happened here. So Peebles, after talking about all this stuff, the completely mostly non-controversial in any way, then just sort of raises the fact that where he thinks there's going to be a problem for the president is in the estate tax. He's going to lose the Congressional Black Caucus, and we'll get to that in a minute, and he's going to lose senators from farm states because it's going to the estate tax could devastate farmers. Now, Hayes immediately says that's a bunch of crap. And it's because that anybody who spent any time looking at this knows that there were 100 families across the country who own farms who were subject to the estate tax. It's not even remote. There will be 300 families across the country who would be subject, who own farms, who would be subject to the estate tax. Under President George W. Bush, the estate tax dropped to 35% after a $5 million exemption for an individual to pass on to his kids. So an individual can pass on $5 million worth of assets, and then whatever they pass on beyond that gets taxed at a 35% rate after that. President Obama wants to raise this rate to 45% after a $3.5 million exemption. Before George Bush, it was 55% after a $1 million exemption. So President Obama is taking us back to a rate that still is below the pre-George Bush tax rates. And there are some Democrats, guys like Max Baucus in the Senate, couple other Democrats in the Senate, McCaskill, maybe Tester, maybe Pryor of Arkansas. Now, Arkansas, we know why. That's where the Walton family is. I mean, we're literally talking about a tax that applies to a certain amount of like a handful of families in this country. And this guy's bringing up the Congressional Black Caucus. Of the 3,600 estates subject to the estate tax this year in the country, 3,600. 100 are classified as farming estates. The number of estates subject to the tax would double under the plan proposed by Obama. So we're talking about an infinitesimally small group of people here. And this guy is out there defending it for some reason.
Let's think about it this way. Let's look at it from African Americans' perspective. You know, hundreds of years of oppression. Finally, there's an opportunity to go and compete in a balanced way in this economy today. But there's a head start. And so of generational transferring of wealth. And so finally now, with equality that's taken place since the Civil Rights Movement, you have a more alignment of wealth.
Do you see what's happening here? The guy is using the Civil Rights Movement is some type of fig leaf for why millionaires should retain as much wealth as possible. And I immediately go into like a complete, I'm almost jumping out of my chair at this point. Now, I should say, I didn't know who this guy was, this guy Peebles. But it turns out that I've since done a little bit of research. It turns out that Donahue Peebles was named, and God bless him, congratulations, one of the top 10 wealthiest African Americans in the country by Forbes magazine. I have it here somewhere, but it turns out this guy has a net worth of millions upon millions of dollars. Millions upon millions of dollars here. Here it is. $350 million as of May 2009, according to Forbes. So when this guy's talking about we need to allow African-American success stories to pass on their wealth dollar for dollar to their kids to catch up to the white people who've been doing it for a long time. But we are still, even when we talk about white people, talking about an infinitesimally small number of people. And in terms of black millionaires, we're also talking about an infinitesimally small number of people. However, one of them apparently was sitting to my left in between me and the Danish on Up With Chris, and he was worth at least $350 million.
And now it's going
You're
to be wiped out by 55%.
Such an infinitesimally small number of people. I mean, literally, we could fit all of the people you're talking about probably in this room.
You're talking about African Americans in the United States who are subject to the estate tax?
I'm not arguing the actual merits of the issue. I'm telling you the politics of it. The Congressional Black Caucus voted with George Bush
the last time around on estate taxes, and they are going to talk about the politics. Okay, so now you see what he's done.
He has now pivoted from making the argument that we should repeal the estate tax to now just being a commentator who's saying these are the politics. I'm not arguing the merits of the policy now. He's made this shift. He's immediately just ducked my assertion about the estate tax. And now he's just talking about the politics. Now, it is true, the Congressional Black Caucus, there were eight defectors back during George Bush's administration that voted with him on the estate tax, I think half of whom are gone. One was Sheila Jackson Lee from Texas, sort of a surprise, but we're talking about the money they get from millionaires. Al Wynn, I think, from Maryland, who's gone. Jefferson from Louisiana, gone because he had money in his refrigerator or freezer or whatever it was. Bishop from Georgia, Scott from Georgia, obviously the same millionaire donor down there. I mean, so we're talking about, he's making this as if this is a big civil rights issue. You had eight defectors from the Congressional Black Caucus who just got bought out.
Well, I don't think anybody wants to cut.
All right, so I go on and basically make that argument with Don Peebles. And then during the break, I basically tell him that what he's talking about is a complete fig leaf. I don't realize at this point that I'm standing next to the number 10 in 2009 wealthiest black Americans in the country. I don't know that he's got $350 million worth of assets. I don't realize that I have not just said that the only reason why the politics are happening here are because of money, but I don't realize that I'm actually saying, like, no, the only reason why there's the Congressional Black Caucus or anybody else doing this is probably because of your money or your buddy's money. And he's using this as if this is a civil rights issue. It's just absurd. And he keeps talking about political reality now into the break. So I am steaming mad because this guy is, he sees me as some type of, I don't know, hippie. And he's during the break, he's going like, well, what about your dad? I mean, how did you, and I said, well, my dad's an attorney. His dad was an attorney. They haven't been subject to the estate tax rule. But even if they were, great. The argument is that he is trying to make during the break that I'm doing this from white privilege. Now, this is a guy whose father was a mechanic, Peebles, worked his way up, got into real estate. God bless. I'm excited he has $350 million. I hope he has $500 million by now. Maybe he has $700 million. It doesn't matter to me. And I'm happy that his kids are going to get $5 million. And then after that, let's say he has $500 million to give to them. They get $5 million, and then they get taxed at a 35% rate on the $495 million. And so they'll end up with another $250 million to spill between the two of them. I don't feel bad for them. So then we come back in after the break. I'm telling him that this is a fig leaf. Hayes comes back. He turns to the talk of cutting Medicare. And here it is.
The big problem is the rate of growth of healthcare costs. I think we could all agree on that, right?
Yep.
Now, Medicare, the rate of growth in Medicare is significantly lower than the rate of growth of healthcare costs in the private sector. So it's doing a better job of controlling costs relative to the private sector. Then we just passed a huge bill that was incredibly contentious, which is called the Affordable Care Act, the vast majority of the legislative language of which is about controlling costs in healthcare over the future. And so it seems to me like the reasonable thing to do is to wait 4 years, 5 years, implement the bill, and see if the cost control measures that have been put in place, thought about tooth and nail, not like, you know, smuggled in the cover of night, like hugely, hugely controversial, whether those cost containment methods work. And then, you know, we can all sit at this table 5 years from now. And I don't understand why this isn't just the opening position of Democrats. And as someone who's on the Hill, shouldn't that be the opening position?
Well, yes.
Thank you. Well said.
So I included that clip where Arenberg at the end agrees. And this guy is sitting next to me, and he's basically agreeing with most of what I've said. I mean, I have no idea who he is. And Hayes has laid it out now, because apparently, I mean, they obviously knew who Peebles was and what he had been advocating. And I should say at this point that in my study of who this guy Peebles is, not only did I find that he was worth at least $300-400 million, apparently he was one of these guys who over the summer told HuffPo that he was mad with President Obama for attacking hedge funders and private equity guys. I look and see at those things that are becoming offensive to some of his strongest supporters financially. It would be unrealistic to think that that kind of thing would not impact the enthusiasm for those who are supportive of the president financially, and certainly would turn off others who were on the fence to say, you know what? What the heck with it? I'm done. And they go on to Romney. So this is Donahue Peebles, who has raised at least between $100,000 and $200,000 for President Obama, saying, it's not me, but there are other people out there. This is the way this guy works it, right? It's always other people who are advocating for certain things. Not him, of course. He says there are other people out there. Now, my support for President Obama is very strong, but there are other people out there who are pretty pissed. He goes on to say, I'm so tired of hearing that the rich are not paying their fair share of taxes. Yeah, we are. The super vast majority of wealthy Americans do not wake up every day and say, let's see how we can pay less than our fair share of taxes. Of course they don't. They look up and say, what a beautiful view I have. Or, man, do I feel great. That's a wonderful $15,000 mattress I slept on. They say, we're going to follow the law and we're going to hire some good accountants to tell us how to do it. And we're going to pay no more, no less than our fair share. What? This is the way this guy's defending paying these lowest tax rates on $350 million since the 1940s? Is, hey, I wake up every morning and I just think I'm going to hire the best accountant I can. So I'm paying not a dime more than I'm legally responsible for. So what should be said is that the wealthy Americans should have their tax rates raised because we need more money. Now, by the way, if they got all these tax raises, it still wouldn't put a dent in the national debt. So that's who this Peebles guy is. And here is where I start to stick a finger in his eye, because I'm pissed. I'm realizing what this guy is about, and it's really pissing me off, and now I'm trying to agitate him a little bit.
Has done in the past. Getting back to your original question, I think, frankly, it has to do with the same thing as why we're debating maintaining historically low estate taxes. It's money. Right. There is absolutely no
reason in terms of the budget to be even talking about Social Security. And in terms of Medicare, it's the exact same thing. I'm sure there are cuts that can be made in terms of efficiencies, particularly when it comes to pharmaceuticals. There's a lot of savings there. I mean, you have...
Right. And then Hayes asked me to describe those, and I talk about where we could have the government be able to get a volume discount for the drugs that it's paying, and we could also get rid of patent, some type of patent reform. We would save $300 billion at least over the course of 10 years. So I've stuck my finger in his eye, and then we come back for the third segment, and this is where I make an argument about means testing. And people and I start going after it.
Really interesting. I want to show some polling because I think one of the weirdest dynamics is this
And this is Hayes talking about the state of play in the argument that we're seeing in Washington. And I had this conversation with Francesca DeSoto during the break where I was like, there's nothing less popular than cutting Medicare or Social Security. It's only rich people in Washington who want to do it. And she just looked at me like, what? It's unbelievable. And so here's Hayes basically drawing out that point.
Match between where public opinion is on something, on what we call on the show social insurance, and where the kind of beltway conversation is about the, quote, entitlements that need to be fixed. And so when you say to people, you will read in the wonk world, and you'll read in Politico, you know, well, people are floating the idea of raising the retirement age on Medicare. This is one of those things. The Republicans are saying, no, it's not enough to sort of whittle around the edges. We need changes in eligibility. That's their kind of, that's the red line they've thrown out. Now, go ask the American people who have just been through an election, how do you feel about raising the retirement age on Medicare? And this is what they tell you.
Now, I should say that eligibility comment, this is, I think, Hayes also baiting people's because he says Republicans are arguing for changes in eligibility, that raising the age, in other words.
71% of Democrats oppose, 68% of Republicans oppose, and 62% of independents oppose. It's very hard to find a less popular, proposal than this. And yet, this is at the not even in the margins, at the center of the conversation when people start talking about a grand bargain. And Sam, you were elucidating a kind of argument for why that was right when we went to break.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the establishment in this country, whether it's the political or the media establishment in this country.
The worst.
They don't have the sensitivity towards this. I mean, when you talk about raising the eligibility for Medicare age, you're talking about privatizing it. You know, the costs aren't going to go away. It's just simply you're going to say instead of support,
for those 2 years, right?
Right, instead of support for our seniors, well, we're going to force these seniors, who in many cases may not be able to afford it, or their kids to pay for it. So this idea that somehow this is, you know, we're burdening our grandkids by not cutting Medicare, well, that's ridiculous.
Right.
Now, I should say what I'm doing there is very consciously taking what I anticipate people's talking point is going to be. Based upon our conversations at the break and how annoyed he was with me, I just had the sense that all of a sudden I realized this guy is a no-labels guy. This is a guy who is basically just a Pete Peterson guy. And this is always the talking point, right? We're burdening our grandkids by actually having the government in some way provide the most efficient health insurance for the grandparents.
Because those grandkids are going to pay for it, and they're actually going to pay more
right.
in the private insurance industry than they would through Medicare. And that's just
enough.
The fact. And so, and I'm talking about those grandkids literally. They don't
right.
they're going to be paying for their grandparents or their parents to get health insurance on those ages if you raise it. So the savings is not going to, it's simply going to, we're going to push it on to individuals, we're going to push it on to the other generations, and we're going to make it cost more because we know that Medicare controls costs more and is delivered more efficiently.
I agree with him, actually, that because the next step of that, of course, is that the kids and the grandkids will be burdened with it, and that's a greater drain in the economy because it takes
right.
their money and spending power out of the economy and puts it into healthcare. However, though, I do think there should be some further adjustments on eligibility. For example, someone like me, I do not believe
right.
that I should be able to get the same kind of benefits
as, say, you know, a retired school teacher.
Right.
And so, therefore, I should have to pay a greater copay. The threshold before I got any benefits should be there. Now, also, if I also my children, hopefully, if they are successful, I think we have a responsibility to take care of our parents, too, right. if we can. The government needs to be helping people who can't help themselves, that are going to have difficulty doing
and this,
that.
And I'm glad you made this argument, because this is the argument that you hear Pete Peterson make, who's a big, you know, sort of funding a lot of the groups that are talking about attacking the debt or the deficit. And you hear Mitch McConnell, but you hear Republicans make it, and you hear some Democrats make it, which is basically, well, look, progressives, you guys care about redistribution, and you care about all these things, equality, and we, you know, that's good. Why have these universal benefits when we don't have enough money? Why have universal benefits for people that have a lot of money? I mean, that's the argument, right?
Indexing it.
Right, yeah. Indexing it, right, but making it a more an adjusted kind of thing.
Means testing.
Okay, so there you have what Hayes has done is basically brought out what the essence of Peeble's argument is. Peeble is shrouding this. First, he says, well, someone as rich as me should have to pay more for my health insurance. And in fact, someone as rich as my kids should also pay for my health insurance if I can't afford it. So basically what he's saying is that this idea of universal access to health insurance for all seniors and ostensibly all people is problematic to this guy. He wants to see health insurance provided only as welfare. He wants to see it only as Medicaid, even though we also know that some 80% of people, regardless of what their income was when they were younger, end up in nursing homes or do so on Medicaid. He wants to make sure that there is no right, affirmative right, to health insurance in this country. That's what his agenda is. And then Hayes basically calls him out and says, yeah, you and Pete Peterson. And so I come back with this, basically saying that there's a very efficient way of providing for means testing. And it's this.
Well, first off, Medicare is already means tested.
Yes,
you
is.
Already do have some measure of that. And if you want to means test it more, there's a very efficient way of doing that, a far more efficient way than to have a new bureaucracy that's going to determine what your net worth is, and that's called taxation.
Right.
And so we take it to you from you on the front end.
Right.
And then, frankly, that's what we should be doing with Social Security. We should be obliterating the cap. We can be raising taxes.
When you say obliterating cap, explain what that means.
Well, the cap right now, the first $110,000 of Social Security wages are taxed at about 6% for the employee, at 6% for the employer, a little bit more, 6.5%. And traditionally, we have taken in, through the Social Security system, 90% of the nation's income. We're now at about 81% because of income inequality.
Right.
If we take off that cap, we have complete solvency in Social Security, not just 20 years out, but until my kid has a kid who is looking towards Social Security. And we can do the same thing with Medicare.
Your kid is 40 years old, though.
My kid is actually significantly older.
Just so that everyone knows what you're saying.
I have a 7-year-old, to the eye can see. And we can do the same thing with Medicare. If you're really concerned about means testing, there's an easy way.
That's interesting. So your point is, don't do it on the benefit side of means test. Just make sure that we're taxing.
Just have people put more money into the system.
What do you think about it, Richard?
Right, I agree with, you know, I think that the cap is, it creates this regressive pattern, you know,
right.
It's the long-term solution on Social Security, but I don't think Social Security needs to be on the table.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem like it's about, yeah, I think we all agree.
Now, that was Arenberg, Richard Arenberg, basically saying that he agrees with that about the Social Security. And the dynamic on Medicare is exactly the same. But now Peeble's has to push back against this notion of, wait a second, my argument to means test. Now, the means testing, he doesn't care about the means testing. Because we all know that means testing, first off, saves you virtually no money. If every millionaire had to pay, and we already have some means testing in the context of Medicare and some parts of the insurance. But, I mean, if you were to provide the means testing he's talking about, we're talking about such a small number of people. unless it became an incredibly a complicated system. But even still, you're talking about virtually no savings. Virtually no savings. So this is not really about means testing. This is about making Medicare into a welfare program, because it is far easier to cut a program that is not providing universal access, that is not for everybody. And that's his real agenda.
I think Medicare
right.
is being discussed.
And same dynamic.
But again, I don't think that we can ask the American people, especially job generators at the top end, to pay.
Wait, what? Job generators at the top end? We can't ask them what?
More in taxes other than what's being discussed.
Well,
now.
You're saying you want job generators to pay more for their health insurance.
Absolutely. At the
so
time
all
of
I'm
consumption.
Saying is, let's
at
the get
time,
the most.
Give it to you in the front end and trust you to spend it well now.
Yeah.
Trust the government to spend it well now.
Well, yeah, I trust the government to.
Now, he wants to do it at the time of consumption. So we have to create this whole bureaucracy that is not going to be efficient to determine whether or not this guy deserves insurance year to year, right? Because he could lose his money. He could lose all his money. That's his argument. It's going to be his argument shortly. They could lose all their money. So we're going to have to do this year to year to qualify, as opposed to making it nice and simple. Raise a little bit on his wage taxes. Raise a little bit on his income taxes. But we can't have that for job generators, because we all know that even despite the fact that Mitt Romney won't hire a guy to make his peanut butter and honey sandwiches, that if you take away any taxes from these job generators, they're not going to hire people. We've asked so much of them.
Spend things as well as anybody else, frankly. And
well,
so,
that's
I
a
mean,
frightening thought there. Okay.
Well, he doesn't like government spending.
Wait a second, though. Right. When we're talking about this, I mean, we could talk about, we should just be very clear, right, about how this actually all works, right? There are, Social Security and Medicare have dedicated tax revenue streams, right?
Yes.
So when you're talking about
some
the front
of Medicare
end,
comes from the
right.
general fund.
Some of it comes from the general fund. But there's income taxes, then there's a bunch of other taxes in the tax code, and then there's these payroll taxes that you pay that create this distinct funding mechanism for these.
Now, so here Peebles doesn't like the idea of actually having to pay up front because, of course, like I say, it's much easier to cut the program if it's seen as a welfare program for poor people and rich people can opt out. Taxes are forever. And then finally, this is where it ends.
Get more to the political aspect of it. So
now, remember, this guy loves to switch between what is political reality and what is the best policy. When you start to argue policy with him, he says there's no political reality. He's trying to keep all of this at arm's length. That's what his plan is. And DeSoto, or DeFrancesco Soto, she's also looking at this in the same sort of fashion. It's interesting.
Maybe popularly people don't want to see Medicare touch. But the Beltway folks, the folks who are going to be voting on this, do want to see that. So what are we
yes,
going
they do.
To bring to the table? Are we just going to say...
Now, I'm going to start this over again because, I mean, think about what she's saying here. She's saying, okay, we've seen that Democrats and Republicans in the high 60s, Democrats in the low 70s, don't want any cuts to Medicare. But the people in Washington do. So what are we going to bring to the table? Who is we in her calculation? Is she now with those people who don't want cuts to Medicare? I mean, why do we have to bring anything to the table if there is no policy justification and no desire by the American public to cut Medicare? What? Why? Who is we, and why do we have to do anything? Let's play it again from the beginning.
Get more to the political aspect of it. So maybe popularly people don't want to see Medicare touch. But the Beltway folks, the folks who are going to be voting on this, do want to see that. So what are we
yes,
going
they do.
To bring to the table? Are we just going to say, we're not going to bargain with you? I mean, at what level do we allow for, say, means testing? We may not like it, but that's
well,
what's
that's
going
my
to
point.
Allow.
Is, listen, means testing, we can do means testing. If you want to do means testing, there's a very efficient way of doing it. We will raise your taxes
right.
on
if you have
what
more
you
money.
If you have more money, okay. into
but
Medicare.
But the reality is, that's not going to happen.
But wait a second. Let's,
well,
no, we can
but
talk
that,
about what we project.
About,
and
look,
but here's
we can talk about cutting
the reason why that's not going to happen.
And put defense spending 20% and put that into the general fund as well.
Okay, so what Peebles is doing here now is saying, but that's not going to happen. Your idea about taxing people more for Medicare is not going to happen. So now he's stepping back. He's no longer advocating a position. He's now just an observer again, right? That's not going to happen. And now, also, to add a little bit of spice in there, he says, we could also cut the Defense Department by 20 or 30% and put it in the general fund. That's not going to happen either. In other words, he's looking at me and saying, I am now going to put you, your idea of raising taxes to pay for Medicare if there's any type of shortfall, into the realm of unicorns and fantasy land. That's what he's doing here with that.
Well, and we would be able to reduce a lot, hold everybody's taxes, but that's an action that's never going to take place.
Wait, wait, so can I follow reality, with
what
this?
She's
wait,
talking about?
Hold on a second.
What she said is actually very valid. What's the fact is that there's going to have to be give and take. However, the president.
Okay, so then he says, well, what she's saying is actually valid. So what you're saying, Sam, is crazy talk. What she's saying is valid. There has to be some give and take here. Now, where is he in this debate? He's pretending like he's just an observer, but in fact, he's one of the key players pushing an outcome. But this is what the new no labels people do. This is what the Pete Petersons do. This is what the Joe Scarboroughs do. This is what the establishment does. They step back from the debate and say there has to be, they set up a context where they know a negotiation is going to lead them to their end. And then they step back and say, we have to all get along. Regardless of how crazy we think the dynamic is here, that's just the dynamic. That's immutable. That can't change.
Has played a very powerful hand by saying, okay, tell us what you want.
But let me say this on the give and take.
There's a reason why we can sit here and say it's never going to happen. And it will never happen until people acknowledge the reality of the situation from a policy standpoint. You can say that the Republicans are never going to allow for a more efficient way of means testing, which is to raise taxes.
That's your
on
opinion.
That's not debatable.
You're not even going to get Democrats
you're
to buy into
politically.
That.
Politically, okay. But I mean, if you will,
well, is that
can,
reality?
Okay.
Okay.
In reality, 40% if you join me right. in acknowledging yeah. the reality that the most efficient way of means testing Medicare would be to raise Medicare taxes now. That's a reality. Whether or not that's going to happen is another issue. But
not
if you join me,
because
we can join together.
Oh,
and
wait, hold on a second. Think about it this way. We just had, we came off in the 2000s, the early to mid-2000s, the biggest boom in the nation's history. Then we went to the second biggest recession in the nation's history. So wealth has been redistributed and lost. Right. Now imagine that concept that you just talked about, where these...
Now, first off, he's lying. Wealth was lost, but I don't know if he's saying that it's just been lost by the wealthy. It's been lost by everybody. And the notion that it's been redistributed is also questionable. He's talking about things like food stamps have gone up. He's talking about things like somehow we have unemployment insurance. But the fact of the matter is that income inequality has grown during this period. This guy has not suffered. But that's his argument. We have suffered. And here he's going to go to job generators again. Now, you saw what I was trying to do there. I was basically saying, okay, you want to have your reality is the politics? Well, then join me in admitting that the policy prescription is wrong. You wouldn't do that.
People are paid into it, and now they're in a different income position. That doesn't make sense. We should be taxed. This is any kind of means test should be done at the time of consumption. For example, if I can afford to pay my health care, I should pay for it.
I mean, if we really...
So there his argument is there are people who lost money, rich people. Okay, this is what he was just arguing, and it's absurd. He's saying that there were really rich people, maybe millionaires, maybe people who made over $500,000 a year, $700,000 a year, $1 million a year, whatever, who paid into the system under my regime that I'm proposing, would have paid into the system, whatever it is, an extra 10 grand a year, 25 grand a year, if they have the millions that he does, maybe half a million a year, maybe 200,000 a year, if he's making whatever, $20 million a year. I don't know, probably less. And then they lost all their money, and now they're on Medicare, and that's not fair. No, that's exactly why you have social insurance. That's exactly why you have social insurance. But that's his argument. Seems a little lame.
Fair about the deficit and debt issues that we're talking about.
Yes, but the key thing here is, which is my mantra, is that no one actually cares about the deficit and debt.
Well,
that's the key thing, people talk about it because it's the word they give to the stuff they really care about.
Right.
Richard Ehrenberg from the Strength and Social Security campaign, Sam Cedar of the Majority Report, Don Peebles of the President's National Finance Committee, and MSNBC contributor Victoria De Francesco Soto. Thanks for being here. That was great.
And that's the end of it there. And so that was my I was rather excited. I felt bad because at one point I cut off Hayes and I couldn't contain myself. I think he understood. I mean, I think to a certain extent that's why he wanted me on there. There were times where off camera he was like, I think, egging me on. But that, if you want to know, if you want to see, and I'm convinced this Peebles guy was just sort of shocked. Yeah, and believe me, he didn't seem too happy with me afterwards. I went up and I, you know, shook his hand because for me that was a tremendous amount of fun. I don't get the opportunity to basically tell a plutocrat, you're lying to the country or you're lying to yourself. But that is the mentality of these people. So when you see the Pete Petersons, and we should say, you know, yes, this guy, a big donor to, or big bundler, I should say, for President Obama in the 2010 cycle, 2008 cycle, I think he was also a bundler for Obama. I'm not sure, but he gave to Raul Martinez, a Democrat in Florida, Rudolph Moisey, another Democrat in Florida, the 17th and 21st. I don't know them. I do know who the Republican Party of Florida is. And back in 2000, he gave $5,000 to the Republican Party of Florida. So, I mean, this gives you just, this is a species of Democrat that exists out there. This is a plutocrat. There is no other better way to describe them. And we had real insight into the way that they argue and how you get from being a plutocrat to the no labels or third way movement. That is to pretend the influence of your money has not changed the political dynamic and then step back and say, this is the political dynamic. Let's just be reasonable here and try and get along. Some people, for whatever reason, we don't need to discuss the merits, don't want an estate tax. Some other people, I'm going to pretend that I'm one of those people until I'm cornered, do think there should be an estate tax. And we can't have it because, of course, there were 8 members of the Congressional Black Caucus back in 2003 that supported getting rid of the estate tax. So this is a civil rights issue. And I'm sure if this guy was a white guy, he would have some other argument. We're keeping out new money from growing, whatever it is. So it was a stunning insight. Wanted to share it with you. Went a little long. We're going to take a break. Go to the better half of the program. We'll do a little extra today. Remember, if you have the opportunity to support this program, please do. It supports my hobby of going on to MSNBC on the weekends and arguing with plutocrats, although it just rarely happens. I've had a couple of good moments like that. But all right, folks, I'm going to take a break. When we come back, 646-257-3920, I will take your IMs. I've got a bunch of them loaded up. We'll be right back in just a moment. So, Thomas, here we are. It is now nearly September 2013. I remember those fateful days 5 years ago. In fact, I remember going into the office of a guy I knew who was working at Bear Stearns saying, you know, I've been reading some weird stuff that you guys might be in trouble. And he's like, no, I just spoke to my bosses down the hall. They're going to let me buy the debt of
of some Central American country. And within, I think, 3 days later, the doors were padlocked.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, 5 years ago. September 15th it was, 2008. That was the day.
And where are we? I mean, well, let me ask you this. If I had asked you in August of 2008, if I had given you a hypothetical, we're going to have this massive bank meltdowns, what do you anticipate where we will be in a couple of years from that? What would your answer have been?
Well, I mean, things were already in a tailspin at that time. Things were heading down, and the real estate bubble, everybody knew it was. I mean, people talked about it being a bubble all the time. I remember, Dean Baker, for example, the economist, is a friend of mine. He was talking about it constantly back in those days, and that had pretty much burst. And but nobody really understood how calamitous it could get. And also, nobody could have foreseen the part of it that really boggled my mind was the bailouts. Well, first of all, that all five of the big investment banks would go down, or would change form, or something like that, or would have their basically be threatened. We're going to go out of business, go bankrupt, and then to have the government step in and rescue everybody. That was astonishing. And then what's unfolded since then is also hard to believe, but it hasn't happened. And by that I mean the lack of prosecutions, the lack of new regulations to make sure it never happens again, that sort of thing, the sort of thing that they did in the 1930s. The absence of that has been quite astonishing. And for the simple reason that it will happen again. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind. Sam, you just interrupt me when you want to. I blab. This is a subject that I could blab about.
No, please. Please continue.
Do you remember the time I was a columnist for the Wall Street Journal? I don't know if you remember this. I was the liberal on their op-ed page, and when it happened, I was in the middle of a book tour, and I was trying to write my columns and do this book tour at the same time. And a couple of days into it, I figured out who the go-to guy was. It was this guy, Bill Black. He's at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, my hometown.
He's been a guest on this show many times, a former regulator during the SNL crisis.
There you go. Exactly. And this guy, I mean, he really opened my eyes when I call him up and interview him, to write these columns that I was writing back then. And he would tell me about the similarities between what was happening and the SNL debacle back in the 1980s. And it's quite shocking, but the SNL debacle ended with a lot of prosecutions, a lot of banks being liquidated, and new rules put in place, a new regulatory agency put in place. And none of that stuff happened this time.
And what do you think, why is that? And we'll get to how we're living with the vestiges of all that was done wrong. But why was it? I mean, why was it that in the wake of the SNL crisis, there was a proper regulatory response and a proper criminal response? I mean,
yeah.
I think, there was 1,000, I think, criminal prosecutions.
Yeah, that's right. But they also had to fight for that now. The SNL, in both cases, these industries obviously didn't want that to happen.
Exactly.
They didn't want that to happen. And so the regulators had to fight for it. And this time around, I don't know. Maybe they did fight for it this time around, but they you're talking about, first of all, you're talking about an industry, the investment banking industry, Wall Street generally, And one of the things that we now know that we didn't know before the crisis is how the model of an investment bank had spread all over the economy, what they call the shadow banking industry, so that basically everybody was doing this kind of stuff. Everybody was was trading debt. AIG, for example, had been an insurance company and somehow got into this business of credit default swaps. You can read the full story in one of those many books that came out at the time if you want, but this was all over the place, so it isn't just Wall Street. It's vast industry that is threatened by the prospect of good regulation.
And so what was it? I mean, was it that because, and, you know, of course, the SNL crisis happened in the 80s. Then we went through the 90s and there was a whole raft of deregulation that created...
Yeah, we never learned. Isn't it funny? And the SNL crisis happened because of deregulation, of course. This very specific deregulatory bill passed at the early Reagan years in 82, what was it called, the Garn-St-Germain Act or something like that, deregulating SNLs.
And it just
turned these guys loose, you know. And it always follows the same pattern that it's often done with real estate, but what the objective always is to deliver bonuses to bank management, you know, always to deliver bonuses to bank management. They deliver the bonuses by hitting a certain target, when you just completely deregulate and let these guys, the term that they like to use is self-supervise, you know, when you turn the supervision over to the bankers themselves and say, well, the market will, you know, take care of these guys and make sure that everybody plays fairly, then that's what they're going to do. Automatically, they're going to set up these kind of bonus structures and start rewarding themselves in these crazy ways.
Well, was it because this deregulation basically consolidated the power of bankers and defanged our regulatory agencies to the extent that even in the wake of this crisis, our response was largely anemic?
Well, there's two different problems there. The defanging of the regulatory agencies is different than the deregulation is when they overturned first they overturned Glass-Steagall, then they overturned, remember that Phil Graham, the senator from Texas, who would have been Treasury Secretary if John McCain had won, you know, the election in 2008. That's how close he got. But he wrote that bill that deregulated derivatives, you know, and then at the same time you had what this is another great term that Bill Black coined, desupervision, where they defunded the regulatory agencies and essentially turned them over to the regulated industries. And they would make, say, a guy who's the head of the trade association for, you know, the whatever group of bankers, put this guy in charge of the regulatory agency. And they did. There were a bunch of different methods that they used to basically, to pull the teeth of the regulators. They would have them. They had, God, it. It was all in the Bush administration, basically. They had something called – this is just – it's mind-boggling that this even happened. Something called competition in laxity. They wanted to encourage this. There are five different bank regulators. Banks were able to, in some cases, pick their regulator. So the regulators had to compete among themselves for the banks. How would the regulators compete? By saying, we'll let you get away with more stuff than the other guy. And so it was a classic race to the bottom. This really happened.
Well, Thomas, we got to take a break. When we come back...
No, we got to keep going.
Yeah, well, we will keep going right after this, and we will talk more about where we are 5 years after the massive bank failures and financial meltdown that has still left us with an incredible amount of people unemployed in this country. We'll be right back after this. So, Thomas, before we broke, and just barely broke, we were talking about the culture of regulation that existed in the lead-up to the financial meltdown. And you mentioned there was a competition between regulatory agencies because banks could choose who was going
certain
to regulate them.
Could. Yeah, that's right. And so you had certain agencies that they liked to go to. The favored one was called the Office of Thrift Supervision. And if you Google them and you look for there's this picture that comes up right away, and it shows various bank lobbyists with the head of this regulatory agency, and they're all holding, like, gardening shears and stuff to a stack of red tape, right? They're going to cut through the red tape. And the guy who's the head of the agency is holding a chainsaw.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. This is in the Bush administration. And this is, you know, this is a classic example of regulatory capture, you know, desupervision. But
now,
that sort of thing was going on. But now it's 5 years behind us. And it's you know, it's a really good question. How has it affected us in the long term? And you know what my take on it is? I think it's to behold this kind of corruption. And when I say that, I mean, I'm quite serious about it, that when we saw AIG get bailed out, and remember the bonuses had to be paid. Do you remember that incident?
Well, because you cannot, you have to, you know, the obligation of a contract is above all else.
right. Unless it's a union contract, then
exactly.
You can do whatever you want.
Right.
But you had to uphold the letter of the contract, which is just so much, you know, it's so FUBAR. It's totally false. The government gets out of contracts. Private actors get out of contracts all the time. There's always ways, but yeah, they.
There's many people out there without a pension right now who know exactly that's the case.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
I shouldn't
laugh. It's horrible. But when we beheld this, when we saw this happen, we saw this go down. Everybody in America, it was right there in broad daylight. That basically the people that caused the collapse, you know. The ones who had at every step in the process had been dealing in what they used to call toxic securities, you know, deliberately packaging them up and selling them off, investing in them or whatever it was. These people were going to not only get bailed out, they were going to walk away rich. They were going to get their bonuses. And in the intervening years, you know, I say, well, they haven't brought anybody to justice. They have. They've law enforcement people have gone after lots of people. They've gone after the people at the very bottom, the people who took out bad mortgages. Even though handing out mortgages like candy was the actual policy of a lot of these mortgage originators, you know. It doesn't matter. So we all saw this happen, this incredible act, blatant act of corruption, first under Bush, and then it continued under Barack Obama, you know, a man that we all had very high hopes for in 2008.
And so where does this do? I mean, what does this do to the national psyche? Because, you know, just this week, President Obama came out and said, you know, he was pressing regulators to finish the financial rules under Dodd-Frank.
Yeah.
60% of the rules are not written. And
And
the reason is because a combination of Congress defunding the regulators, but also those to be regulated have basically prevented these regulations from going because there was not a wholesale restructuring. Rather, there were these broad laws that were to be executed by regulators as opposed to some big statutory changes like saying break up the banks. Where are we now in terms of what has this done to our national psyche?
Well, look, you've got a president that was really unwilling, and I've written about this many times. You've got a president that's really unwilling to go back and find fault in the past and blame people in the past. And, you know, I understand why he does that, and I salute his motives. I think his heart's in the right place. But he doesn't understand we need to have that reckoning. We needed to have that reckoning. I mean, I think it's too late now. I think that you've corrupted the nation. I think that the entire nation is corrupted. We saw something like that happen, and we saw that these people got away with it. And here we are 5 years later, and the president is saying, "Yeah, we gotta get around to that one of these days. gotta write those rules. Come on, guys." Still, 5 years later, I think that it has, in a sense, corrupted us, made us less sensitive to awful things like that. It has made us extremely cynical, and not just about banks, but about government as well. And that's a consequence that I don't think we're going to get over for a very, very long time. Look, I remember when I used to in the Bush administration when I would like to write about people's attitudes towards government and towards the state, and in the aftermath of the financial crisis in 2008, people's cynicism towards government spiked upwards in this dramatic way, you know, after the AIG bailout, and it's never going to come back. I mean, without someone explaining to us how they're going to change things, they're going to force bankers to play by the rules. That sort of thing, you know, it's never going to come back.
Well,
we saw everybody in this country that, you know, scrimps and saves and tries to play by the rules and obey the law just get ruined. And the people who are the predators and who love to flaunt their predatory, you know, nature and rub it in our faces, those people got bailed out and got a bonus, you know, to boot.
Well, Thomas, one can only hope that at least the younger generations will figure this out in a way that sadly ours couldn't. But thanks for joining us, Thomas.
Sure, anytime, Sam.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice was made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. The months shifted into years, while I shifted in and out of. Pilot light shining bright.